This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 14th of January, these are our main stories. The pro-democracy and sovereignty candidate William Lai wins Taiwan's presidential elections.
Over the last 8 years, we have tried continuously to extend goodwill. We hope in the future, China will realise peace serves the interests of both sides.
UN officials call for calm after 2 days of US-led airstrikes against the Houthi movement in Yemen. And
is Ecuador a narco state?
We are fighting every day so it doesn't become a narco state. I do believe that we could win, and I will never stop fighting until we win.
We have an exclusive BBC interview with the president of Ecuador, which has seen a recent explosion in gang-related violence. Also in this podcast, Russia declares the exiled best-selling fiction writer Boris Akunin a foreign agent, and prosecutors in Peru on the reported discovery of alien mummies in a cardboard box.
These are handmade with synthetic glues, unless extraterrestrials have brought their glue from another planet, which I don't think happened.
The people of Taiwan, which China claims as its own, have defied warnings from Beijing by electing a candidate who has vowed to maintain the island's democracy. William Lai is from the Democratic Progressive Party, which secured a third consecutive term in office. China insists the island will be reunified and hasn't ruled out using force to do so. Our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes is in the capital, Taipei, and sent this report on the day's events.
A huge crowd in central Taipei welcomes the man who will be Taiwan's next president. William Lai is a former political firebrand, but these days speaks softly. That has done nothing to assuage China, which considers Mr. Lai a troublemaker. It told Taiwan's voters that choosing him would take the island closer to war, but the threats and intimidation didn't work. His supporters say, if anything, it had the opposite effect. She says Taiwan's future will be determined by its own people, and that Chinese leader Xi Jinping should learn to be quiet during Taiwan elections. Nevertheless, at his post-election press conference, President-elect Lai was quick to offer Beijing an olive branch.
Over the last 8 years, we have tried continuously to extend goodwill. Unfortunately, China has not responded to these gestures. We hope in the future, China will realise peace serves the interests of both sides.
At their campaign headquarters, Taiwan's main opposition party, the KMT, the whole party leadership bowed to their supporters and asked for their forgiveness. The KMT had run on a platform of getting closer to China. Beijing's preference for the KMT may actually have contributed to its defeat. Many Taiwanese view it as far too friendly to China's communist rulers. Instead, they gave the party China hates an historic third presidential win. Now everyone is waiting to see how Xi Jinping will respond.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Taipei. So what does this election result tell us, and how indeed will China respond? Questions for our correspondent in Taipei, Shaima Khalil.
I think it tells us that Taiwan is still going to go with the self-governing stance, which is to take Taiwan away from China's orbit, closer to the United States, closer to other allies. And this is something that has continued to anger Beijing. Remember, Beijing calls William Lai the troublemaker. But also, I think he himself was very robust when talking about China in his victory speech and answering questions in his first press conference, saying that he will ensure the safeguarding of Taiwan against any aggression or intimidation from China. I don't think we're going to see any easing of tensions between China and Taiwan anytime soon.
So strong words from China, but will there be anything more than strong words? Because the worry, of course, is military action.
The worry is military action. And remember that in 2022, after Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, China flew aircraft and it crossed the dividing line in the Taiwan Strait. And that was very worrying. And since then, you know, there's been aircraft carriers, for example, going very close to Taiwanese waters. Anything that happens between China and Taiwan also affects Japan and the whole region. What's interesting, I think, Alex, is that when I spoke to voters, they were saying they were worried about the economy. They were worried about housing, especially young first-time voters. They're worried about employment, and they want to see the government deliver on these issues. But at the back of everyone's mind, I think, is that possible aggression from Beijing. And as one voter put it to me, she said, look, yes, of course, it's worrying. But remember, we've been living in the shadow of those threats for years. So yes, but there are other urgent matters on our mind when it comes to day-to-day.
Shaima Khalil speaking to me from Taiwan. Cool heads are calling for calm after 2 days of US-led strikes against the Houthi movement in Yemen. The UN's special envoy, Hans Grundberg, called for maximum restraint, while his boss, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, urged all sides to avoid escalation. But those calls seem to be falling on deaf ears, with fresh attacks on one Yemeni port being reported on Saturday. Prior to that, the US military said it had hit a radar site used by the Iranian-backed Houthi who control much of Yemen and have been attacking international shipping in the Red Sea. The Houthis have continued to show their defiance. Their leaders there watching as a drone dropped a bomb with precision onto a US flag and rockets flared into the desert sky. Our correspondent in Beirut, Hugo Bashega, is closely monitoring events in Yemen and the Red Sea.
People who know the Houthis say that these attacks are unlikely to stop them. So far, they haven't done anything. They fired a missile yesterday that didn't hit anything. And the expectation is that they're going to respond, probably by carrying out more attacks. And I think perhaps as an indication of that, the US Navy has alerted American flag vessels to stay away from the coast of Yemen in the next few days. So it's very likely that things are going to remain very tense in the Red Sea.
Is there any indication that anyone involved is willing to listen to those calls to avoid doing anything that might make this already precarious situation even more dangerous?
Well, the Houthis have been saying that the attacks they've been carrying out are in response to Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. And the Americans and the British are saying the strikes are about guaranteeing freedom of navigation. They say that it doesn't have anything to do with this situation in Gaza. Obviously, all these events are connected. President Biden has been saying that they were trying really hard to prevent an escalation of the conflict, and now American missiles are hitting positions in Yemen. Nobody knows what's going to happen, how the Houthis are going to respond. But President Biden today said the US had sent a private message to Iran who support the Houthis. He didn't give details, but he said, I think we are well prepared.
Hugo Bashega in Beirut. Lieutenant Colonel retired Adam Clements was the US Army attaché to Yemen between 2017 and 2018. Rebecca Kesby asked him about President Biden's latest comments, saying the US had delivered a private message to Tehran. Who could have helped America to deliver that message? And why is Joe Biden telling us?
This is some public signaling to many different factions, stating that the United States is talking with Iran, signaling also to other leadership in the region. The United States is directly talking with Iran about this matter, at least specifically in the Red Sea. In the past, Oman has definitely been a very important communication link between the United States and the Houthi movement, as well as to Iran. And then also, within the past year, a very important detente or rapprochement publicly with Iran and Saudis, renewing some of their open or at least public communication could have been through multiple methods.
And what do you make of these strikes led by the US, were they a good idea, or is there a danger that the US is actually being played by the Houthis and their associates to draw them into a wider conflict?
I personally am pessimistic about their effects. This, I think, could have a limited long-term effect on Houthi ability to strike ships in the Red Sea. It's very important to know that the Houthis have withstood years and years of an air campaign that the Saddle-led coalition led since 2015-26 timeframe. And the Houthis have actually been in a state of war well before this. They're very adroit at protecting a lot of these different assets that they've had, and over the course of time, especially the past 10 years. I do, however, think that the maritime coalition that the U.S. Secretary of Defense Austin announced was forming in the latter part of December, that is the better use of military resources. We don't want to escalate the conflicts in the Middle East when we have more fighting back and forth or possible escalation on the Lebanese border with Israel. We all know what's happening in Gaza. We also have to remember that there are U.S. and other coalition forces operating in Syria and Iraq. You have to look at resources that the U.S. and others are trying to use to support Ukraine against Russia. So it's hard to make this pie bigger with resources, and that's what I feel is just not worth it right now. It's definitely not a perfect solution.
Lieutenant Colonel retired Adam Clements speaking to Rebecca Kesby. As the world's attention focuses on events in the Red Sea, Israeli forces have kept up their bombardment of Gaza. There's also been further violence in the occupied West Bank. We'll hear more about that shortly. But first, I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Reda Al-Morwi, if people in Gaza were at all able to follow events off the coast of Yemen.
They are indeed. Of course, communications are very difficult inside Gaza because of the lack of electricity. But they are updated of what's happening in the world through local journalists who've been reporting on the conflict for almost 100 days now. And they recorded many messages from the people of Gaza saying thank you to the Houthis because they see this as the sign of solidarity with them. And many of these videos are actually now on YouTube. And they say, we wish that many other Arabs would have stood with us like the Yemenis did.
Still no let up, though, in the Israeli attacks on Gaza. And still it seems to be the women and the children who are bearing the brunt.
Yes, an overnight Israeli army attack on a house in Rafah in the south of Gaza killed 10 Palestinians. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, they said that in 24 hours, 135 Palestinians have been killed. And reports from the Nasser Hospital in the south of Gaza said that a two-year-old girl is among those who have been killed. This brings the total number of victims to date since the beginning of the conflict to 23,843 Palestinians, and 70% of them are women and children, according to medical sources there.
And I understand some rockets reported going in the other direction too.
Yes, Israeli radio said yesterday that rockets aimed at Ashdod in the south of Israel came from northern Gaza, which is an area in which Israel is saying the Hamas military infrastructure has been completely destroyed.
Meantime, there's yet more violence in the occupied West Bank.
Yes, on Friday, the Israeli army announced the killing of three Palestinians. It claimed they attempted to infiltrate a settlement west of Hebron in the West Bank. The Palestinian authorities said later that there were teenagers from a nearby village, aged between 16 and 19. And Israeli press is saying security chiefs in Israel warned Benjamin Netanyahu that the West Bank might actually witness be a third uprising like the one that was in Israel and the occupied territories in the early 2000s. And they added that the Islamic Jihad and the Hamas are working together in the West Bank, which poses a bigger threat to the security of Israel.
Reda Al-Morwi in Jerusalem. Football now, and the opening game of the Africa Cup of Nations 2024 has taken place on the outskirts of Abidjan between the hosts Ivory Coast and Guinea-Bissau. The contest is a model of competitiveness and unpredictability. Since Egypt won three in a row between 2006 and 2010, there have been six tournaments and six different winners. Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick is in Abidjan and watched the game. So did the men of Ivory Coast get off to a flying start?
They did, and they secured a 2-0 victory in the end, but it wasn't a particularly impressive performance from Ivory Coast. As you say, it was a very quick start. Sekou Fofana capitalising on a mistake in the Guinea-Bissau defence, but a very good finish from him, giving the goalkeeper no chance. That was on 4 minutes. Guinea-Bissau did have a few chances themselves, which they spurned. And then Jean-Philippe Crasso on 55 minutes got the ball inside the penalty area, juggled it around, and then squeezed the ball in under pressure. And that was it, really. The crowd were getting a little bit impatient with their team. Not a full house here at 60,000 capacity. The official attendance, only 38,000, which is a bit of a surprise given the fevered anticipation in this city and this country ahead of this opening match of the Africa Cup of Nations.
Yeah, you talk about that fevered excitement. Is the excitement that AFCON always generates going to be justified this time?
Certainly the atmosphere in Abidjan, where this match took place, just on the outskirts of the country's economic capital, it was fantastic. Everybody dressed up in the country's colours, the green, white and orange of Ivory Coast. Every time you spoke to someone, first of all, they would welcome you to their country, and then they would want to talk about the Africa Cup of Nations. They're really proud that they've been able to put on this tournament. They've built six stadiums, four of them new, two of them have been refurbished. They've built roads, new hotels, updated their hospitals. Over $1 billion has been spent, and they're proud at what their country has been able to achieve. They desperately want their team to go away and win this tournament as well to top it all off, but they've got away with a win in their first match.
Alex Capstick. A pair of strange-looking Peruvian figurines and a three-fingered hand found in a cardboard box at Lima Airport are not, you may be surprised to hear, alien mummies. That has been confirmed by prosecutors in the Andean nation, as Rachel Wright explains.
At a dramatic press conference, officials presented two dolls about 30 centimetres tall. One was a broken naked man and the other apparently female, in a pink and yellow long dress with a yellow headdress, a nod to traditional Andean attire. Appearing alongside them, a gruesome-looking three-fingered hand. These objects were seized in October at a courier office in Lima Airport. Customs agents say they were destined for an unnamed person in Mexico. At the time, some local media outlets speculated that they were aliens. But on Friday, Flavio Estrada, a forensic expert working with Peru's prosecutor's office, said the objects were not extraterrestrial, but were in fact made here on Earth with paper, glue, metal, human and animal bones.
These are handmade with synthetic glues which did not exist in pre-Hispanic times, but are from the 20th century. Unless extraterrestrials have brought their glue from another planet, which I don't think happened.
And this was not an isolated case. Just a month before these mummies were found, journalist José Maussan presented similar-looking figurines, these completely naked, to the Mexican Congress.
Aquí hoy vamos a presentar...
Spending more than 3 hours trying to convince them they were aliens discovered in Peru. Maussan had made similar claims in Peru in 2017, but they were swiftly debunked by a government report stating the so-called alien mummies were actually recently manufactured dolls. Julieta Fiera, an astronomer from the University of Mexico, said the dolls were a modern representation of an ancient custom.
Traditionally, when an important person died, children were buried with them. There are many mummies of children buried with important people in Peru.
There is real sensitivity about alien conspiracies in Peru. There are widely debunked theories that sites such as the ancient citadel at Machu Picchu, known as the local city of the Incas, was in fact built by aliens. And indigenous communities say these claims threaten to erase their history and heritage. In this latest case, Peruvian prosecutors have proved definitively that the dolls were not alien mummies, so not such a close encounter after all.
Rachel Wright with that report. Still to come in the Global News podcast, can real translators be replaced by artificial intelligence versions?
Until you can find an AI that understands vibes, you're not going to have AI that is able to translate as well as a human being.
It's been a turbulent time in Ecuador, where a series of deadly attacks, kidnappings and prison riots have shocked the country and the world. Days of unrest saw two notorious gang leaders, including Fabricio Colón Pico, escape from jail and prison guards held hostage. The recently elected president, Daniel Noboa, declared a two-month state of emergency, and the gangs retaliated by setting off car bombs, attacking schools, universities and shops, and even stormed a television studio, threatening staff with guns during a live broadcast. The BBC's Central America correspondent Will Grant spoke to the president in the country's most violent city, Guayaquil, which is also where Mr. Noboa was raised.
I didn't sign up for this thinking that it was going to be easy. It's very tough. But we cannot continue in this game these terrorist groups are trying to establish. Now we're starting to see changes.
The US State Department say that they're sending a delegation of law enforcement, military and diplomatic personnel. What's your reaction to that latest information?
I'm glad. It's encouraging. And to see the international community actually paying attention now to what's going on here, because I think it affects the whole world. The narco-terrorists that operate here have operations in Europe, in the US, and I think that we need to solve the problem from the roots, and the root of the problem is here.
There's currently around 178 hostages still being held in prisons around the country. You said you're not negotiating with the armed groups, so what are you doing to try and free those men and women?
I cannot give exact details of what we're going to do, but we are in constant communication with the armed forces and with the police. We're going to do everything in our power to bring those people home.
Where is Adolfo Macias Villamar, alias Fito?
Right now, we're looking for him. We do have a few leads. We've talked with the armed forces, also with international cooperation, and we're working on it. We cannot give any alerts, but we're going to go till the end, and we're going to find him, and we're going to find Colón Pico.
Is Ecuador a narco state?
We are fighting every day so it doesn't become a narco state. I do believe that we could win, and I will never stop fighting until we win.
Ecuador's President Daniel Noboa speaking in an exclusive interview with the BBC's Will Grant. On Tuesday, President Emmanuel Macron of France tried to inject a much-anticipated new lease of life into his flagging administration by appointing a 34-year-old as Prime Minister. Gabriel Attal is one of the youngest persons to hold the position. He's also openly gay, another first for France. So, can he help President Macron halt the advance of the far right? Our new Paris correspondent Andrew Harding has been finding out.
We've come to a market in Vanves, a suburb of Paris, and it's here that France's new Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, used to be local MP. So we've come here to find out what people make of this extremely young, 34-year-old Prime Minister, and whether he can strengthen the government and stop France's what seems to be a slide amongst the electorate towards the right and the far right.
Il est jeune, bon, bien sûr, mais enfin, il est certainement très compétent, mais bon, après...
What's your name?
Brigitte.
Brigitte. So Brigitte here is saying he's competent, he's young, certainly, and we'll see what happens with his politics, but he's very experienced already. What's your name, sir?
Johan.
And how old are you?
49.
What do you think of Attal, your new Prime Minister?
Un peu de jeunesse, je trouve ça très très bien, moi. Et ça met un petit coup de fouet un peu dans le gouvernement français qui est un petit peu vieillissant.
Saying a little bit of youth, an injection of youth will put some energy into this government, so he likes the fact that Attal is young. I've arranged to have a coffee with the new local MP here, Claire Guichard. She's hoping that a young prime minister can persuade voters to back their centrist Renaissance party in June's European elections and not the far right.
Oui, il y en a une réelle inquiétude.
Yes, we are very worried. You need a moderate government to manage a country. There is real danger from the extreme right. It's true that Gabriel Attal is the only one who can bring people together.
What do you hope he will bring?
Hope for the future. New energy.
Gabriel Attal has hit the ground running as Prime Minister, sympathising with flood victims here.
Quand on parle de sécurité, quand on parle d'ordre,
and delivering a tough message on law and order at a meeting this week with police officers. It's clear the government of President Emmanuel Macron is trying to reach out to voters on the right with a tough new immigration law. Will it work?
My name is Antoine Bristiel and I work in political science. So it's quite positive for the moment, but we will see, especially during the European elections and maybe after, when Macron will have to pass unpopular laws and he still doesn't have the majority at the National Assembly.
Et c'est sans doute le plus important, c'est aussi dans le cœur des Français.
And it is this woman, Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right National Rally, who could benefit. She hopes to be France's next president, and she has her own youthful team around her.
My name is Melina Bravo, and I work in the communication.
I presume you're quite young. Can you tell me how old you are?
I am 24.
So there's a big drift to the right in French politics, as we're seeing in other parts of Europe. Why is that?
I think that people, they realize that what makes sense today is the program of Marine Le Pen. People are struggling.
Are you concerned now that there is this young Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, who seems very popular? Is that going to take votes away from you?
Honestly, I don't think so. He was like well appreciated by French people, but I think that now he's going to be the first minister. People, they're going to dislike what he does and he's going to have a decrease of popularity. And he's like Emmanuel Macron at the end.
The first test will come at those European elections in June, as a new generation of French politicians step into the limelight.
Andrew Harding with that report. There's been an outcry on Russian social media after the Kremlin designated the best-selling author Boris Akunin a foreign agent. The blacklist already includes most leading dissidents and anti-war activists. Here's our Europe reporter Sasha Schlichter.
Boris Akunin's books charting the exploits of the dashing Tsarist-era detective Erast Fandorin have enthralled an entire nation, with sales pushing 20 million. Born in Georgia as Grigory Chartishvili, Akunin was never an establishment author. He was so disgusted at Vladimir Putin's Crimea land grab 10 years ago that he left Russia for exile here in London. 8 years later, on the day the president launched his full-scale invasion, he wrote, "Russia is ruled by a psychologically deranged dictator, and worst of all, it obediently follows his paranoia." In its ruling, Russia's justice ministry cited Akunin's stand on the war and accused him of distributing false and negative information about Russia and of helping raise money for Ukraine's military. The foreign agent designation obliges a branded person to identify themselves as such on social media and in other publications. Reacting to his new status, the 67-year-old author quipped, "I feel like Bin Laden, who has been handed a parking ticket."
Sasha Schlichter. The maker of the language learning app Duolingo has laid off about 10% of its contract employees, saying it was increasingly turning to artificial intelligence to create lessons. This includes a feature that allows users to chat in a foreign language with an AI bot. So could other language-based jobs be at risk? Julian Warwicker asked the South Korean writer and translator Anton He if his job could be done by a machine.
People have this idea that translation can be very easily done by a machine. However, a translator does a lot more than just change one language to another. We have to understand context. We have to understand nuance. We have to understand what's trendy. And no machine learning model that I'm familiar with is able to do that as well as a human, because there simply aren't enough translators who can feed a model like that enough data. Because if you want to create an AI that translates as well as Anton He, then you need 1,000 Anton He's to give it the data that it would need. And there is only one Anton He, and he was very expensive for my parents to raise. So I really don't see this happening in my lifetime or in my children's lifetime or in my grandchildren's lifetime.
Why would there be so many barriers to a machine being able to get even close to what you did?
When you translate, for example, a book, and fiction is the art of the perspective, a novel completely changes depending on who tells the same story. And sometimes you have to make decisions in the translation process, for example, where it's written in a first person, but you need to change that into a very close third person. I mean, that's a very drastic change, but sometimes that's what's good for the book. And you have a discussion discussion with the author, and then you have a discussion with the editor. And so there are those major decisions that make a huge difference. An AI is just not going to be able to appreciate the difference between the two resulting narratives.
Presumably in some works of fiction as well, you are coming upon words written in the original language, which don't have a ready translation. They might even be made up for the purposes of that specific work, mightn't they?
Exactly. Arguably, even within the same language, the same word does not mean the same thing for the same people. For example, when I think of the word bicycle, I'm going to think of a different kind of bicycle. It's going to have a different connotation for me than it does when you think of the word bicycle. And we're speaking the same language and we're saying the same word. So if this kind of discrepancy exists within speakers of the same language, it's going to be even worse across different languages. It's like what the famous translator Jeremy Tiang says. We don't translate words, we translate vibes. And until you can find an AI that understands vibes, you're not going to have AI that is able to translate as well as a human being.
Anton Herr speaking to Julian Warwicker. Saturday was a chance to wish all our listeners happy Knutsmas. Yes, St. Knut's Day is the 20th day of Christmas, and it's celebrated in Sweden and Finland as the last day of that holiday season. Traditionally, Swedes and Finns smash gingerbread houses, dance round their trees, then strip them of decorations, eating the edible ones, and then dispose of them. Some get burned for heat. But in Sweden, they've also revived an older custom, as our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhardt explains.
What to do with your festive tree if it's not a reusable plastic one or a live one in a pot? It's a dilemma wherever Christmas is celebrated, and, as this Stockholm resident explained, often a sad one at that.
In Sweden, you give the Christmas tree a personality. You take it in and you choose it very carefully, and then you live with it. And it's also a bit sadness of time passing by.
Swedes even sing about throwing them away. But cheer up, there may after all be life after death, even if that means, paradoxically, sending your fir or spruce to a watery grave. Since 2016, a Swedish sports fishing association has tossed more than 1,000 trees into the icy winter seas off Stockholm.
We tie 3 or 4 together and then we tie them to a weight, in this case rocks, in a bag. Everything's biodegradable. And then we throw them out into the water and they will sink down to the bottom.
Marlene Schelin of Sport Fiskarna told the AFP news agency their dense branches and needles provided great spawning grounds for fish, with plenty of places for the young ones to hide. It's helping replace lost natural habitats.
If we look around here, there's been a lot of building. We have a lot of boats going in and out. So we need to keep these coastal ways clear. There's not a lot of reeds, and those are really important habitats for fish that have gone missing.
The association aims to use only trees that haven't been sprayed with pesticides. Environmentalists have welcomed the initiative. Many coastal wetlands, important fish breeding grounds, have been lost to agriculture as marshes are drained. So Yule can be cool for fish too.
Danny Eberhardt. And that's all from us for now. But there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast at the same time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Davith Evans and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.